Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice. We here at Shattered Lives are very excited to welcome you this evening to this unique show, taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator, getting to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. Prior to the show, please go to www.donnagore.com or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of case or the organization featured each week before the show is aired. And please don't forget, if you can't listen each week from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern, you can always go to our site and press the link at any time for our archival feature. Good evening, everyone. This is Donna, Lady Justice, welcoming you to another show. And I have with me, as always, we're the dynamic duo, I guess, Lady Justice Donna and Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity. Welcome, Delilah, and thanks for being here with me.
Donna?
Yes?
I'm here. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I lost you.
How are you? I'm fine. You know, the beauty of having the show is that we have such diversity of topics. And although it may seem that I'm a little jovial at times, we deal with so many hard topics, Delilah, and so many heartbreaking topics. And I go to work every day and I deal with people that have very sad lives. And I really believe that our show is here on a mission to not only educate people, but also do it in a way that presents it such that, you know, we show our human side. And that's what I try to do myself with my personality. And it's about having fun as well. So I want to let people know that. And I also want to encourage them to go to my website to read my blogs and to also go to, especially people in law enforcement or crime victim advocates, because I'm looking for a new career in those areas, and I think I have a lot to offer. So please do go and read that blog and contact us if you have something interesting. And I guess without further ado, maybe we should talk about our esteemed guest tonight. I'm very excited to have Tim Pombach. You certainly have heard of him before this show, right, Delilah?
Oh yeah, through Henry Lee Institute. Yes.
Yeah, Tim is an associate professor and chair of the forensic science department at the Henry Lee Institute of Forensic Science that's affiliated with the University of New Haven. And prior to that, he served 22 years with the Connecticut Department of Public Safety, retiring as a major in charge of the Division of Scientific Services. And he has many different research interests. However, his bailiwick in the area that he specializes in is crime scene reconstruction, and we're going to get into that in a minute. But I just want to let people know how I've been to many conferences for crime victims and heard Henry Lee, but the first time I think I saw Tim was I happened to watch the documentary, The Staircase, about Michael Peterson. And please, all you people, because our friend and colleague Diane Fanning wrote a premier book on that case. And Delilah, I don't remember the title, but I'm going to encourage people to read her book about that. But also rent the documentary, The Staircase, because Tim is in that. So without further ado, let's bring Tim in. Come on in and welcome to Shattered Lives, Tim. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, Donna. Hi, Delilah. It's my pleasure to be here today. And this is a great thing that you're doing. And, you know, unfortunately, families and people are really what all this is about. And hopefully justice is the end result for everybody. It's certainly what everybody wants to do.
Right.
Sometimes we don't get there, but it's certainly our goal. And I think it's interesting you brought up the Michael Peterson case. I don't know, have you followed that case lately?
Well, I in fact did a special. Yes, we did, and I know lately, maybe you want to bring the bring the listeners up to date, because I think there is a new chapter in that case. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Just a couple months ago, I went back down to the state of North Carolina to testify again in a hearing regarding whether or not Michael Peterson would be granted a new trial, and he was. He simply was. And it really, it's very much to do with bloodstain analysis and crime scene reconstruction and the manner in which it was done by the officials in North Carolina just didn't meet the standards. I guess that's probably saying it nicely.
Yeah.
And there was lots of concerns with their work or their lack of the quality of their work. And you know, I had worked on the case from day one, and we were all just was so concerned that what was being presented was not scientifically defensible. And that always brings a tremendous concern to us. So the good news for him and from a point of justice perspective is he is going to get a new trial, and he absolutely unequivocally deserves one. But, you know, the side turn of that is Kathleen Peterson is dead, and the family was fractured over this. And, you know, I don't know if that healing will ever occur, but I know for a fact that not getting this right the first time and forcing family members and Michael Peterson to go through this a second time is really the one thing none of us ever want to see happen.
Right, and how do you feel in terms of the role that you play? Is it very common that you go back to testify? Does that happen very often in trials?
No, actually, it's really really quite rare, particularly when you get a guilty verdict. You know, I'm glad in the sense that we were just so concerned with watching the quality of the work down there in this particular one individual who was a big part of the state's case there, and really feel like really feel like this isn't just, this isn't the way this is supposed to work. This isn't the country that we want to live in. You know, we want to solve cases, and we want there to be justice, and we want the guilty people to pay the price without a shadow of a doubt, and that's one of the only consolations that a victim's family can have. But when it runs this course, boy, just absolutely nobody.
Well, when something like this happens, Tim, you know, in such a high profile case, number one, where do you feel that the crime scene investigation goes wrong with the information that they're bringing to trial? You know, you would think that all law enforcement agencies and prosecutors would dot all their I's and cross all their T's before taking it to trial. So what happens? What happens in a scenario like the Michael Peterson case? What happened here?
Well, you know, and let me add a little backtrack, too, because, you know, I hope it'll balance a little bit. You know, when I first testified in this case, I was an active major with the Connecticut State Police, you know, in charge of our lab system. And I was vilified for taking the case. I mean, they were really angry that, you know, how dare a state police officer, you know, take this on my own time, of course, and no expense to the state of Connecticut. This defense case, and my point was, you know, we're trying to do the right thing. Who cares? What is the issue here? You know, and in fact, you know, my point of view as a police officer and as a lab technician, you know, I care desperately that we get this right, and so I really felt it was my moral obligation to do that.
Right.
And felt lousy, really felt lousy when the verdict went away that I didn't think was defensible. So, you know, this is, I think, a good shot that we can go back and do that.
Well, and they seem to put so many of their eggs in the basket of that blowpoke, you know, the blowpoke that suddenly turned up at the 11th hour, you know, and then you said it just had all this dirty stuff on it.
Right. You know, I think what really went wrong there, and it really cuts to the heart of what my, you know, where my area of expertise and passion lies, you know, being crime scene reconstruction, is they worked backwards, and that is to say that from all perceptions, it looked like they had an idea that they wanted to try to prove, and man, is that's not only scientifically wrong, it's just downright dangerous. You know, our role in crime scene reconstruction and forensic science is we've got to remain objective. We got to put ourselves in the neutral position, and we've got to take the facts, and we've got to look at them in an objective fashion as we can. We've got to do our analysis that's completely scientifically defensible and verifiable. And where it comes, it comes. You know, whatever that outcome is what we all have to learn to live with.
At what point in a trial like that do you take the scientific evidence and the so-called circumstantial evidence and all the other evidence combined, and they come up with a conviction?
At what point in the trial? I'm sorry. Do they get the conviction or?
Well, how does that all come together as far as, you know, okay, let's say just hypothetically you felt that the scientific evidence wasn't defensible, but maybe all the other circumstantial evidence and everything surrounding the case combined with that came up with a conviction. Is that plausible?
Yeah, and you know, that's absolutely it is, and that's really a great point because that's another thing that's so key for those of us who work in this field and as scientists, that I have to not worry about that. I have to take the evidence on face value. I have to do my analysis on face value. I have to report it honestly and objectively. And I may do that sometimes in the face of a ton of circumstantial evidence, and that's really fine. And the glorious part about our judicial system is it's meant to embrace that. So that's what jurors do. They get to hear me and decide, you know, how much weight should we give to my work?
That's why I was wondering how often does the solvability of the case depend on forensics? Is it better to have, in terms of obtaining a conviction, have minimal forensic evidence or lots of circumstantial evidence, or does it just vary depending on the particular case?
Well, I'll tell you, lately the game has changed. 20 years ago, circumstantial evidence, eyewitness testimony, confessions were the bread and butter, the backbone of the justice system. They certainly got it right sometimes, and over time we've seen that there's some real legitimate concerns with running a case in that manner. The tide's really turned, and now I think it's almost impossible to go ahead and get a case before a jury and get a guilty verdict without some physical evidence. And I think generally that's a good thing, but you know, there are some times when I can look at a case and we say there's just overwhelmingly strong circumstantial evidence, outstanding job by the investigators and the police, and for whatever reason, you know, a more or less lack of physical evidence in there, and they're in a terrible position to try to move forward. So I think that all those types of evidence do have some inherent value. But I think whether we like it or not, forensic science has taken the main stage and will likely be that way for quite some time to come.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems to be, and that certainly is the way it's portrayed in the media. Would you be able to maybe walk us through what you do in the actual crime scene reconstruction if you come upon a scene? And, you know, can you just give us a hypothetical scenario of some factors we may not be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, one of the key elements, and, you know, now, unfortunately, in my current position, I'm not an active member of a crime scene unit, so I'm very much at the mercy of those who do that full-time, and by the way, that's a really hard job. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm being critical of them, and I certainly don't want to, because it's just an incredibly demanding job.
Mm-hmm.
But that...
Well, it's hard, you know, I can imagine in your position that it would be difficult simply because are you either hired by the defense or the prosecution in these cases?
I am now. Yeah, I was actually referring to the people that have to do the crime scene analysis, and they're usually part of the police department or working for the police department, and they just have to get it right. You know, there's a ton of pressure on them because they set the bar for where we're going to go. I mean, whether they recognize the evidence and then properly collect it and then properly preserve it, whether they properly document it, which would include good photographs, good video, good sketches, every bit of that is what I need to do my job, and I'm completely dependent on them to do it. You know,
depending on them, yeah.
Absolutely, and I can't tell you how many times you know, somebody will consult with us about a case that's just not going well, and the first thing we say was, just let us see what you have. And you know, we'll spend a few weeks looking at it and get back to them and say, I've just got terrible news for you. There's, you know, it's your garbage in, garbage out center. There's nothing I can do for you. There's just nothing here. at any level to work with. And to me, those are just the saddest of cases, because the chances of those cases ever being resolved is just really small.
And is that because they did such poor quality preservation of evidence or collection and that type of thing?
It could be that. It could be that simple of a fundamental problem. Other times, it's a jurisdiction that didn't have the resources for some of the enhanced technologies that we use now, whether it be, lasers or other, portable instrumentation, which really helps us, find very, very trace amounts of material very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, you have jurisdictions that are just up against it. They're getting 2 and 3 and 4 major felony level cases, per shift for 2 and 3 and 4 detectives, and they're overwhelmed. So, at the end, they're not necessarily, meeting the standard, but it's really hard to be critical of them when they're
right.
under that situation. But unfortunately, that the best forensic lab in the world with the best scientists and the best equipment is only as good as is what you bring them.
Mhm. And if they don't have the adequacy or certain quality, those are the ones that sit on the shelf for years.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah,
right?
they really do. Or the other alternative is there's such a pressure from society to solve a case because it's such an egregious case or a high profile case, they'll just solve it one way or another. And we hope and pray they get it right, but they may not. And then we're really stuck with the problem, which is a case which isn't solved correctly and not just in the end.
Right. So we realize that in your current position too, and you're doing a lot of teaching and working with the scientific evidence that you're handed from the other people that collect the evidence. If you put your other hat on, and when you were out there doing that, what were the particular steps involved in creating that? And then do you go back into the courtroom, and do you make a scale model of it sometimes? Or, I'm just trying to get the whole picture.
Yeah, it's you definitely need some level of demonstrative aid, and that could be as simple as a blow-up poster-sized crime scene sketch that was done with a series of photographs or slides and maybe, a few minutes of videotape. Or, nowadays it's getting far, far more complicated, and currently a lot of times we're using computer animations to demonstrate what we're trying to articulate. Early on, those were really problematic because they tended to be a lot of guesswork. They weren't necessarily based on the factual detail or information that we were generating. But more and more and more, the people who have the capacity to create these renderings are extremely, extremely talented, and they're very, very reliable, very, very accurate renditions of what may took place at a scene. And they're really powerful and helpful from a jury's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you find that juries these days are demanding more evidence in order to come up with a conviction or an acquittal?
Yes. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Where it is a bad thing is where the and I hate to use the term because it's so cliche and getting, old as the CSI effect, but, their exposure to the pop culture and never-ending CSI shows, it's been great for the universities. Like I said, we have a never-ending roll of students coming through the door with an interest in it. But it's tough on the jurors because any one of those particular shows you watch, it's basically the same layout. They always get the right evidence. Their analysis always yields a positive result. It always identifies just one person, and they always end up with a singular, unique theory of the case. And I'm like, I've never lived a case that happened.
Right.
It's beyond unrealistic. So sometimes we have to uneducate the jury, because they get mad. They're like, well, why didn't you find DNA? Don't tell me that. If you didn't find DNA, I don't think this guy did it. Yeah, and we're like, well, wait a minute. There's a million reasons why we didn't find DNA. Let's have a conversation about that.
Isn't it about what you can fit into 60 minutes with a few commercials?
Right.
Right. I mean, in terms of this theory of the crime.
And we may be 9 months, a year, 18 months. We worked a serial killer case out of the Hartford region, and it was 10 girls that were killed over about an 18-month to 2-year period. And
what year was that, Tim?
It went back to the early 2000 range, right around 1998. Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, Hartford had a couple of those, but this particular one, you know, it bothered me on a lot of levels. But you know, the girls that were getting killed were, you know, the girls that unfortunately a lot of times society looks down on. I don't really understand why. If anything, they should look up to them because their life's been so hard. You know, they've had a life on the street and drug addiction and everything else that could go wrong. And they're victims in so many senses of the words. But we really put our best foot forward to try to stop these killings and help these girls. And let me think about where I was going with this. But that particular case, we ended up doing, I can't even tell you how much work. And in the DNA area, I believe we did somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500 separate exams. It was well over a year's worth of work. And it took all of that until we finally got our first lead in the case based on the DNA evidence. And it was very interesting because when we finally, you know, finally sorted through this very, very convoluted mess of data and made what we thought was a potential identification, it seemed to run contrary to where the investigation was going, and they even had done a behavioral profiling of what cases should be related and to general nature and scope of what they thought the killer would be like, and this was not consistent with that. But thank heavens, people maintain a very open and objective mind, and we continue to go down that road, and we develop more evidence, and then more evidence, and then more evidence, and the case really came together quite nicely.
I'm sorry. Speaking of the profiling, how often is that kind of gel with what you're coming up with in your reenactions or you know, in your investigation? Does the profiling usually come out right, or does it usually come out wrong, or is it kind of a 50-50 thing?
Well, you're really going to throw me under the bus on this one.
and
I'm going to also disappoint a lot of your viewers, I think. In my opinion, it's rare that it has a real big value. Two things commonly happen. One, they'll say, okay, we have this series of sexual assaults of younger women, and we believe the male is between 18 and 25 and lives within 30 miles of the incidents. I'm like, yeah, we kind of knew that anyway. I mean, that's kind of common sense. So,
well, it's not so generic.
Right, a lot, exactly. And so it's not that they're wrong, but a lot of the features are so generic, I'm not sure that they help us. Then, you know, we certainly have had other cases where, you know, we bumped up against it with the what I would call the hard evidence, the physical based evidence, and when you get like you said a good team, and everything's all about teamwork, but when everybody's on board, when the investigators on board and the crime scene people are on board and the district attorneys are on board, then even the crime scene profilers are on board, we can work out those differences and you know, openly respect each other, and then we don't seem to get in trouble. Where you seem to get in trouble is when somehow, in my opinion, the profiling gets done early in the investigation,
mm-hmm.
and everybody hyper-focuses on it. And I think it was a case in Louisiana was very much like that. It was an unsolvable series of sexual assaults, and they were convinced that the offender had to be Caucasian. And so they refused to look at a suspect that wasn't Caucasian for well over a year. A week into changing that decision and looking at non-Caucasian offenders, they solved the case. It's something that's simple. I'm sure there are other occasions where it's absolutely been the gel to pull the case together, but from my perspective, I get more concerned than I do get excited by it.
Yeah. Is there a particular a framework that you use, like if you're using all of these different strategies to help solve the case, and one of them being profiling, you know, that maybe that would be farther down the line, you would look at this type of entity and then something else, and then profiling after that? Is there a particular order that you want to examine those types of entities that will increase the solvability?
That's an awesome question. I don't know that I have a really good answer to that. This is what I will say, though. I think if you're looking at ultimately getting this right, that the more of these independent pathways that are going on at the same time, the better. So let the police go out and do their interviewing and talk to people and see where they go. Let the behavioral scientists, you know, look at their social science medias and figure out what makes sense. Let the lab analysts, each and independently, the fingerprint people do their stuff, the DNA people do their stuff, and then let the crime scene reconstructionist people put their elements together and see where it goes. If all four or five of those prongs, you know, running in separate, you know, separate pathways of work come together, that's nice. That's really nice. You know, that's corroboration that we're really on to something that's right there. It's, you know, it's a check for us to make sure that we're not being tunnel visioned or not subject to bias or any other concerns.
Yeah. Where do you find the media, when the media gets involved in something, is it helpful or does it usually hurt the case? As far as, you know, bringing all the information like you were talking about, bringing it all together so that it gels and can be taken to trial, how do you feel about the, you know, the talking heads talking and talking and talking?
Yeah.
The Nancy's.
Well, I don't have much use for the talking heads, so I'll leave that go. But the media in general, I'm not going to vilify them because I can tell you, you know, they are problematic. But I can think of cases where they've been fantastic, you know, where, you know, we've had a unique watch or some really unique feature that was found at a crime scene. And we're like, if we could just identify the owner, we're home free. And they've been and we've made that kind of information in a timely manner to the media. And they did due diligence and they helped us solve the case. So we can have tremendous partnerships and they can really help. You know, where I see them a problem is, you know, we can think of two high-profile cases in the lovely Florida state that both were just, you know, from my perspective, just nuts, You know, they took this emotional tangent so far, you know, that the American public was, you know, their mind was so made up before they really got to hear the evidence, and I think that is really a that's inappropriate. That's not doing anybody any good.
The Anthony case.
That was one.
That was one. Yes.
Yeah. And then the current shooting case down there. I think you just got to let that go. There's a lot of emotion behind it, but let them do their job. Let's find out what happened before we jump to some conclusions.
Huh. You know what? I'm also wondering. Kind of gets back to your crime scene reconstruction aspect. What constitutes contamination of a crime scene, and if it occurs, is there any way to salvage the scene or the evidence if it does? I mean, you know, we're not supposed to like walk in it, but are there lots of different ways to contaminate a scene, Tim?
Absolutely. And a matter of fact, you almost got to expect it. Crime scene analysis is a couple foundations that are principles that are behind it. One is called the Locard exchange theory. The Locard exchange theory is simple. It says that whenever two mutual surfaces come in contact with each other, there is a mutual exchange of matter across both boundary lines. What does that mean
in English?
Yeah. Well, here's what it means in English. If I'm going to go inside a house and kill somebody, part of me stays and part of the house comes with me. And we call those linkages. And to the extent that we can identify those transfers and linkages, we'll solve this case correctly. So that's a theoretical principle that's true.
Are you talking about like you leaving your skin cells in there?
It could be.
Something like that?
It could be that way, absolutely. And, you know, and a skin cell would be a really good example because I'd say, okay, we've demonstrated that theoretically that's a correct principle. Now the question is, what's the probability of a crime scene investigator finding my skin cell, which is called the recognition phase, and is perhaps the most difficult phase and the most complex phase of the whole process. And depending upon the scenario of the case, it may be almost impossible. In other cases, it may be very possible. But you know that sets up what we believe to be our success of the scene is how much contact, how much transfer, can we detect it, can we not detect it?
Mm-hmm. Wow. very interesting. You know, a couple weeks ago, Delilah and I were in North Carolina for the Q Center for the Missing Conference, and we had a forensic anthropologist there who was a very interesting person. That she gave this information and advice to someone when we were talking about cold cases and trying to find information, and I didn't know how realistic this may sound, but she advised families of the missing to call their local medical examiner's office, asking them to assist with looking up information on the cold cases. And I'm just thinking, given the backlogs and, you know, the lack of funding that states and municipalities have and whatnot, is that a realistic approach, or are they going to just say, sorry, I'm too busy? Or, you know, I mean, is that something that a crime victim could realistically do, Tim, if they're trying to get answers about data that might be stored at a medical examiner's office?
You've got so many layers of problems there. Number one, you know, is there some inherent confidentiality here? And they can't just publicly disclose a lot of that information. It would be inappropriate for them to do so. And that's
okay.
That's very much the case on an unsolved homicide. You know, because see, you know, one way to say, well, I'm a victim's family member and I have a right to pursue this, which you do, but what's to say you're not involved? You know, the case is still and nobody's got a capacity to know that, and you're not going to be able to discern that in a 5-second phone conversation. So that right away is the issue. Now, the other problem is of what value is that going to be for an untrained individual? You know, so you give them data, what are they going to do with it? They you know, they don't have the inherent training to understand it. And I'll tell you, oftentimes forensic results are so complicated, those of us within the field have a difficult time trying to figure out what does that really mean? What is that really telling us? So, but having said all of that, you know, to some extent, the squeaky wheel does get some attention. You know, and I think back to in Connecticut, we had a really, you know, not every homicide's absolutely awful. But this was, you know, just a young, wonderful woman, you know, in her prime of life that she killed in downtown New Haven. And it was called, you know, it was a Penny Sarah was the woman's name. Go back to the 70s on the case. And if you remember that particular case, what a long road, you know. Wrong people were identified, wrong people were arrested, case charges dismissed, new suspects developed, you know, the case gone cold. But all the time, her father, John Sarah, was very polite, very respectful, but very persistent. And you know, he had a long laundry list of people that he would talk about. I knew that once a year on the anniversary, one of those people would be Dr. Lee, and he'd call the lab and he'd say, you know, Dr. Lee, I know you're doing due diligence. I know you have too many cases, but my daughter's case, and you know, I need your assurance you're going to continue with this. And you know, Henry would say, yes, you have my assurance. And so
what would happen then? I mean, would the dust blow? Not that there was dust on it, but would he actually do due diligence and go back and try to relook at things?
I think you must
get so many requests like that.
you do. But I think what you do is you keep in the back of your mind, okay, what is the evidence I still have, and what couldn't I do with it? And then, you know, you just wait for a new technology to come out, and then hopefully in your mind bank you can say, okay, this new technology might help this case and this case and this case.
Right.
And then you go back. So keeping it fresh within the person's mind, you know, can be beneficial. You know? And in that case, like, we had a great outcome. You know, just really as a fluke of the matter, you know, Grant gets himself arrested on a domestic violence situation 20-some-odd years after the incident, gets his fingerprints for the first time in the APHIS system, and voila, we now have a correlation and the case is off and running. And now DNA is there to take over where forensic serology and early renditions in DNA weren't successful. And the next thing you know, the case is solved. And the only sad part about that whole case is John Sarah had died, I think, within about a year prior to that.
Before, like, right. Was that
yeah,
the one
he never got to know
the,
it.
the was the material on a Kleenex box, or maybe
exactly.
I'm thinking someone
else. Exactly.
That is the one.
Yeah.
I can't believe I remembered that.
Yeah, excellent.
Wow.
Excellent. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it is pretty amazing. You know, what are the biggest misconceptions you think the public have regarding what forensic scientists actually do? I mean, other than, you know, them rapidly solving cases and they're always being, you know, dead on in terms of one perpetrator and all of that. Can you educate us as to the realities of what you do versus what we see on TV?
Yeah, and then let's talk about a couple different subject matters or disciplines. You know, I think DNA is kind of the big one. Everybody wants to have a conversation about DNA, and
okay.
DNA has been wonderful. I mean, it's contributed so much and allowed us to solve so many cases, but it can't do it all. And every now and then, you know, even our professional training or with our students, we're telling them there's another world beyond DNA, and don't get overly addicted to it because you're going to get yourself in trouble. It's not going to solve all your problems. Let me go a little bit further with that. One of the things that's really happened over the past few years with DNA is it's the ability to deal with very, very small, very, very old, very, very low quality samples, things that are really common to the forensic world. And so we're getting now what people call low copy number DNA or touch DNA. We're basically, you know, starting to pick up just a series of cells almost from a transfer. And while that would seem exciting, and wow, isn't that wonderful? It is wonderful in one sense. It is
mm-hmm.
a wildly big nightmare in the other sense, because it's like, be careful what you look for. You just might find it. And
uh-huh.
so now we start finding these very small amounts of DNA all over the place. And now the really tricky question comes as well, what's the relevance of that?
Do you have too many suspects then? I mean, is that the case where how does that play out?
Well, you have secondary transfer concerns. You know, I touch something, somebody else just touches something, and now they transfer, you know, my DNA onto them. That's a concern.
If it's a hotel, you have a million people stayed in that hotel room, right?
Exactly. You know, heaven knows what went on there, and what kind of materials you could find. Way too many for people to know and be comfortable to ever stay in a hotel again. But that's exactly right. And so. You know, very often people say, could you, you know, this is a cold case, you know, and you're going to, did the medical examiner take fingernail scrapings of the victim? And if we just did that, we'll solve the case. And the problem is we may be able to take that and we may be able to generate a DNA profile, but you know what? It may have been a casual contact and it may have been, we may give you a profile of somebody who will never identify. And now will become the ultimate hyper-focus of the investigation and really has nothing to do with the case. So,
uh-huh.
And there are a couple of very major cases right now that was exactly what happened. You know, mm-hmm. a very, very small amount of DNA was located and investigators put all the eggs in the basket and said, that's got to be the perpetrator. No, maybe not.
You're saying to them it's not the end-all, be-all, but so what else are you trying to encourage them to look at if, you know, that this isn't necessarily the end-all, be-all?
What else are you
telling them to focus on?
I think what we tell investigators is be careful. Okay, we're going to – so we tell you that we found a very small percentage or a low copy number of value of DNA on the surface. We'll say, hey, don't stop doing your job. So if that can identify a name for you, you've got a long way to go yet. Figure out what's the relevance of that. You know, was this a person a suspect anyway? Okay, if they were a suspect, do they have routine, regular access to the victim or the victim's surroundings or home? If no, that's great. If yes, well, okay. That's a whole other problem. So, you know, we constantly tell them this is just a result. And that's why I said earlier, you know, I have no problem with circumstantial evidence and other bits of investigative information because they have to come into the picture in order to paint the whole picture. It would be crazy, in my opinion, just, you know, to take a blind DNA test with nothing else and go into court and say, that's it. We're gonna try to get a conviction on this. That's it. It just doesn't seem responsible to me in the vast majority of cases, if not every case.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think it is something that we have to go into trial and paint a whole picture and not just hinge, you know, a conviction or an acquittal on one piece of evidence. And sometimes that seems to be the case. They are banking on this to bring it one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right.
Not to change the subject, but I have a question, I don't know, you know, maybe the rest of the audience doesn't know this either, but what are your feelings on the difference between, and I know this is sometimes a problem throughout the country, as we've seen in several cases where medical examiner offices are coming up with the totally wrong cause of deaths. There's, you know, issues with backlog and all kinds of messes. But the difference between a medical examiner's office and a coroner, I know that across the country in a lot of jurisdictions, we don't have medical examiners. We have coroners.
Right.
Yeah, and generally speaking, again, well, we'll speak in general terms, the move away from the old English elected coroner-based system to a medical examiner system is a good one. The medical examiner system tends to be one, with more more protocol, board-certified forensic pathologist rather than just a medical doctor. With a keen interest in this, increased skill sets, increased validation and quality assurance, increased training. So medical examiner's office often have field personnel that have a high volume of training that can correlate, you know, pattern evidence from the scene. They just tend to grab a hold of the whole picture in a better sense than the more historical, classical coroner-based system, which is usually, you know, a local official, who's an elected official, who may or may not be a doctor, and even if they are a physician, they may or may not be a forensic pathologist. So there's just a greater chance of them getting it wrong, particularly if it's a complicated case.
Mm-hmm. And is there more chance if you're in a rural area that we typically see that they don't have the resources, or there's, you know, miles to travel to the nearest big city, and are they typically do you see them at the the closest medical school or big university hospital if you live way out in the sticks? I mean, how is a family supposed to get the right information if they live way out in a little podunk town?
Yeah, you're right. And generally speaking, that is where there is a greater concern. And the problem is, if that's a lack of a resource, then there's probably all kinds of lack of resources. They probably don't have a high value, high output, highly skilled, qualified crime scene unit. And maybe they have a regional lab that only has certain services available, not all the services available. So, you know, some of the toughest cases I've worked on come out of those very small communities where perhaps the people working there try to do their best, mm-hmm. but for lack of resources, it just wasn't good enough. And then, you know, what confounds that situation is often those families themselves aren't exactly laden in resources. And so it's not as if they can go out hire their own consultants all over the place, which somebody with more wealth could do. You know, I think you could always get the best of the people come in, regardless of where you are, if you had the resources to bring them in, or you found the people that would be kind and generous and I think ethical enough to do some of this work for free. But that is a problem.
Those are the kinds of families we have on Crime Wire, one of our other shows that we feature. And you're exactly telling the scenario, and we try to help them the best that we can, but it's not easy. In terms of where you work right now, I know that you're interested, or one of your other areas is constantly, you know, developing new technologies. Can you talk a little bit about what's kind of on the horizon that it seems to have a lot of promise, or things that you're working on now that people might not be aware of, that's the latest and greatest technology?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're always pushing that envelope. I mean, that's really our number one, our desire and our intellectual interest, but I think it's also our greatest obligation, particularly as a university, to really make it something meaningful for the field. We're working really strongly in the area of what's commonly called teleforensics, and you know, we have a couple grant initiatives and projects going right now. Here it is in a nutshell. We've realized, as I've said, that what takes place at the crime scene is just unbelievably important and all too often not done to the level it should be. And some of that is just a basic, you know, lack of equipment. Others of it is just not enough training. And even if people have training, you know, maybe some of these, that, you know, crime scene units see one or two homicides a year instead of 300 or 400. And, you know, here's a great corollary. If you needed a heart valve replacement, are you going to go to a physician that does 2 a year or one that does 200 a year? And obviously we're going to pick the guy that does 200, right? So repetition matters. So one of the elements of the teleforensics is we have a command center in our institute. It's one of our major entities. And what it is besides a bunch of big TVs and touchscreens and all kinds of really cool things like that, we have all kinds of data communication link capacities. So we can basically have images, data, voiceover, whatever we want coming into us live time from a crime scene. And we have a group of experts that are in-house and a group of people that are consultants that we can connect to. We did this just about 10 days ago for a homicide in Taiwan. And,
In Taiwan.
And they needed some consultation, and you know, unfortunately, that was a 12-hour difference. So we were fighting as to who was going to be up in the middle of the morning, who wasn't. but it allowed us to, you know, to get some expertise to them real time, where it would make a difference. And nowadays, it's not just sending video and high resolution photos to which is really helpful, but we actually have some portable instrumentation, you know, like an infrared spectrophotometer. It used to be, you know, the size of a coffee table or larger. Is now the size of a small attaché case and battery operated, and so we can get some. You know, we can begin to get some of this small instrumentation out in the field, and actually get analytical data back to us while they're still there, and we can say, hey, you know what? That we'll tell you what that substance you're looking at is, or you know, no, you're not. You know, we're not finding anything unusual. Keep looking, and so those capacities, where we can get that kind of high-level expertise and high-level of analysis out in the crime scene unit, are going to be huge, just huge.
Wow. It sounds like it has so much potential. Now, is that a unique feature of the Henry Lee Institute? And talk a little bit about, you know, the institute itself and how it compares. Are there other similar entities, or would you describe it as a one of a kind? Because I think we all should come and get a tour, Delilah. I really do.
Yeah, you definitely have to come. We have a wonderful public learning area. Yeah, it's free. We have a wonderful public learning area.
Oh,
you can
wow.
come and see it and learn more about it. Yeah, that is our unique twist. You know, and really, because from its inception, it was founded by Henry Lee, and you know, Henry Lee's greatest contribution to the forensic field, he's done much, has been really to bring the elements of crime scene reconstruction to the forefront, and for all of us who've been his students, to teach us how to do that in a really scientifically valid manner. So, yeah, there are forensic institutes throughout the country, some better than others. There's many good ones. But I think that, you know, that really is who we are, and we really do that very, very, very well, this whole concept of crime scene reconstruction.
Yeah. Do you typically have, like, how do people get to be a candidate? Do you have, like, a huge backlog? It's like, take a number at the deli, and we'll see if we can help you, you know, in, like, 8 months.
Oh, boy, yeah. You know, Dr. Lee was trying to gear himself down the last running total. I think he had 800 open cases. I don't know what he's going to do.
800.
He's retired,
too.
And how, yeah.
Well,
how can you prioritize that many cases? I mean,
yes.
how do you How can you decide which one to do first?
Right, well, yeah, I think for him, he just had, you know, as he went from Chinese to English, they forgot to teach him the word no, so I think that's his problem. You know, I can't tell you how many times I get called to, and you're very frustrated because I will try to limit myself so that if I am going to work for a case that I can give it some due diligence, because I think it's not fair to say yes and then throw it in a box and just ignore them and keep people waiting. That's the last thing that people want, the victim's family.
Right.
Want.
So you must have criteria,
Yeah, you really just have to listen to it. Try to divorce yourself from the emotion, which always is there. And I try my best to only take the cases that where I think I can make a difference. They're all important. They're all legitimate. They're all the number one case for that family, and rightfully so.
And how long does it take you to determine that? Is it like, you know, a couple days? And I'll get back to you. I can help you. No, I can't.
A lot of times, just on the phone call, you know, I'll say, "Hey, talk to me. What are your issues here? What are your worries? What are your concerns? What are you looking for?" And sometimes, you know, it's just clear that I can't do anything, and if I can find somebody to refer them to, I'll definitely do that. And sometimes we just have, you know, conversation, and they understand that at the moment nothing's new, but I say, you know, let's hang on. You know, there's always new things developed. Other times, I'm like, that really does sound interesting, and maybe I can help. And then we start the long, slow dance of sending materials, and let me start looking. And you know, and that process can take months sometimes of back and forth and back and forth before we realize that there is something here. There's a possibility here. Then oftentimes we have the difficult task of bringing everybody together, because it's one thing for me to be a consultant to come into play, but you know, this. You got to get the police back interested, and the medical examiners on board, and the district attorneys on board. Everybody's got to jump into this same race, as it were, because it can't be a one man show, and that's often the biggest obstacle.
That's probably the hardest part, right? To get everyone's interest. You might be very fired up about helping, but the other people may not be.
Absolutely correct, and that's a real heartbreaker, and I really don't have a good advice on that one. I just don't know what the answer is.
Well, I know. You know, it sounds like you are such an advocate for crime victims. And we have about, maybe 8 minutes or so left to the show. A couple things I'm wondering, and Delilah, just chime in there too, because there's so many things we could ask. We're going to have to ask them to come back on another show, maybe Crime Wire or something. But what, in terms of what you do, you split up your time. Partially you're teaching students, other times you're doing research, and other times you're being called to court. Is that how you divide your time, or
good job.
Like?
Yeah, those are my three primary.
I just guessed.
yeah, you hit it exactly right. Those are the three primary things, and you know, we do the best to balance them. You know, at any given time, things. You know, the weird thing that I've always found about court is I can go, you know, 9 months to a year and not walk into a courtroom, and then in 1 month I can be in four times, and I'm like, oh, you know, and often it's not anywhere nearby. It's a plane ride away, so it's a big time commitment to do that. But you know, I think you'll find that many of us have been around for a bit of time in the field. Really see these needs, and when we create a little bit of time for ourselves, because we move into a position like a university position, we put it as a priority to try to give back and do some of this pro bono work and be there to make a difference for those cases that we just know are going to fall through the crack, and that the system just can't grab a hold of. Because you know, when you're a lab director in the lab scenario, the grind is just crazy. Without exception, those labs are under-resourced and underfunded.
How many people, just to give us a snapshot of the realistic picture, how many staff do you have versus how many cases you're supposed to be working on, or, you know, that type of thing?
Well, with faculty and institute personnel in combination, we have around 14, 15. I think 15 is the number, and we're all kind of in the same situation. Where you know, we have these varied responsibilities. Our staff is great because we're real balanced. So, you know, there's two or three of us that can do the crime scene reconstruction piece. There's people that are molecular biologists and do the DNA piece. We have trace analysts. We have chemists. We have fingerprint experts. So, you know, we can, when we see a problem, we try to get it to the most experienced, best person possible. Mm-hmm. And again, every now and then things get out of imbalance and we get 15 DNA cases in a row and we're just like, we just can't take anymore. Or reconstruction or what, you know, DNA analysis and reconstruction tend to be the more common needs, to be quite honest with you.
It sounds like it would be. What would your message be to, crime victims' families who may be listening and have unsolved cases, whether it's, you know, just in general or in specific? We don't want to burn your phone wires up having them all call you tomorrow.
Right.
What would you generally say to them if they're looking for help as a general rule, whether they live in a big city or a rural area? How can they best approach this?
Yeah, wow, that's tough. I want to say it was something that it doesn't sound like it's the answer, but I think it's important in that many of us really do care. And I think they feel sometimes like they're hitting their head against the wall, that the system's given up on them, that their loved one's not important. And I promise you that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, you know, the system is what the system is, and it's just plain overwhelming, and we just don't have the resources we currently need to do that. So my recommendation is that there's a really fine balance to be tenacious. You do have to kind of continue the pursuit and the hunt and the quest for justice, because somebody's going to have to do that, and it's probably going to have to be them. And then be patient. Yeah, and then be patient, because this can be really complicated for people to, you know, to find the time and make the time, you know, to help them amongst the, you know, hundreds of other people. And then to, you know, a lot of this work is very complicated, very detailed. There's multiple layers to it. You know, other experts have to come in and get out and take a look at things. So there's just a need for just, you know, that balance of persistence and patience and large volumes of both.
Wow. Yeah, I know, and that's the hardest part for those people that have unsolved cases, for sure. Just as a kind of an afterthought to what we were talking about in the beginning, are you going to be involved in the new trial with Michael Peterson?
Oh, well, you know, I testified to extensively to get his new trial, and I absolutely unequivocally will be available to do it. You know, it's ultimately up to the attorneys to make those decisions.
Uh-huh.
I mean, frankly, I kind of hope that the state of North Carolina just does the right thing. It may not be possible to fully remediate this mess that's been created,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, it comes a point in time when people just got to stand up and say, regardless of the political outcome or opinions, I'm choosing to do the right thing.
Well, you know, we all have to follow our conscience and follow our heart, and, you know, you certainly have, you know, and your science, and you know what's right and wrong. We have just a little, well, maybe like a minute and a half or so. Delilah, do you have anything vital before we have to sign off, and hope that Tim will keep in touch with us, because I think he can be a valuable resource to people like us in the future?
Oh, this has just been a fascinating conversation for this hour. It goes by so quickly.
Yeah.
And, yes, I would like to keep in contact with you, Tim, and I know some people who may possibly either use your services or maybe want to book you on another show if you're willing.
I'll certainly, you know, do my best in any way to help you guys out.
Thank you.
I certainly feel for the families, and again, you know, they're certainly in our thoughts and prayers, and they're the ones having to live through it. We're not.
Well, I
right.
tell you that this company, that, you know, there's a lot of really good people here, Tim. So thank you so much from the bottom of our heart and giving up your time this evening. And we do want to stay in touch. And before we sign off, I just want to say this is Donna Gourley.